June 14, 2021, it's a Walk for Pedro show. Pedro Show. Happy Monday. Started off with John Coltrane doing Blues to Elvin. Doug Clifford, For All the Money in the World. And my guest, via Skype, you're in Reno, right?
Yes.
Okay. First, I'd like to start with how you got into music. Bring me your earliest musical recollection.
Well, I bought my first record when I was 9 years old. And it was Roll With Me, Henry by Etta James. And my dad hated it. That's one of the more vivid memories that I have of that. The record I bought was Bo Diddley by Bo Diddley.
Yeah, great tune.
And you know that tom-tom rhythm thing.
Yeah.
Really just, you know, I didn't know what the hell was happening, but it was making me feel pretty darn good for a 9-year-old. I'll tell you that.
Now, the pad you grew up in, was there musical instruments?
No, but my mother was a singer, and the radio was on, but it was adult radio. It was before rock and roll, for sure. I'm 76 years old, so that, you know, you go back to those days. She would sing a lot, I knew that later on, when I was a teenager, I knew that she really kind of got married young and would have loved to have been a singer on the radio.
Oh, wow. Now, at school, were you in the marching band or the choir or shit like that?
No, because they wouldn't allow you to play rock and roll.
Oh, really?
It was forbidden. Yeah, we're talking like 1958. We started the band about 1958. We were 13 years of age, John and Stu and I.
I was born in 1957.
Oh, yeah.
Sputnik. Okay, let me ask you this. How did you get on the drums?
Beg your pardon?
How did you get on the drum? I mean, what made you think, like, you wanted to do rock and roll, right? And you like that tom-tom beat with the Bo Diddley song. But what gravitated you towards the drums?
Well, a television special, actually. I was thinking about playing the sax because back in those days, the solo instrument wasn't the guitar. It was the saxophone. And there's some great stuff. Now, that was that crossover between R&B and country. That creates rock and roll. But I was watching a television special on Gene Krupa, the great Gene Krupa, and he was out on a football field, and you couldn't see the band, and they had like 10 drum sets set up, and he walked through there as they played. And he was playing on the cymbal stands and not really getting into the drum part until it was Sing 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 too, by the way, was the tune. And then when they hit that big chorus and the horn section kind of came roaring in, he sat down and started, you know, playing the whole drum set. And I just said, that's what I want to do.
Gene Krupa, yeah, amazing cat. Okay, so he's the inspiration. And what about, so did you, you know, I've had people on the show. Well, even in Elvin Jones's Different Drummer documentary, he said he started on pots and pans. Did you do that?
Well, I actually used my school books, so I wouldn't be telling my mother a lie when I told her I was doing my homework. So I set them up at my desk, and I had a little brass lamp that was popular in the 60s or late 50s, had a little flex mac on it, and it was cone shaped, and I had my pencils out, and those are the pencils I never sharpened. I would play along with listening to the Top 40 radio, and then I would listen to the R&B station as well, and I would listen to the drummer and and trying to figure out what it is that he was doing. There were no female drummers at that time, so ladies, don't, I'm not leaving you out intentionally when I say the guys there's some pretty good female drummers out there nowadays.
Oh yeah,
that's good news. But so my mom would, I had the radio as barely cracking, just so I could hear it, and she would kind of open the door, and then I'd hear her footsteps coming up, and so I'd just flip open one of the books, and, what are you doing? I'm doing my homework. she would have wanted to bust me. She said, you're doing your homework with pencils that haven't been sharpened.
Oh, man. So when do you get your first trap kit?
Well, I bought a snare drum and wrought iron was very popular for like chairs, canvas chairs, and holding flower pots. And there was one of those that I balanced the drum on, and if I hit it, it would knock it off of there. So that needed improvement. And a neighbor gave me a bass drum. But it was a marching bass drum, but I didn't really know the difference at that time, and I needed something to make noise. So I got a foot pedal, and so then I realized, when I saw John Fogerty in the music room, the teacher could not have been in hearing zone, because he was playing rock and roll. He was playing records that I had in my collection, and so I listened to him until he stopped, and then I walked up and I said, "That's Fats Domino and Little Richard." "No, for no." He says, "Yeah." I says, "You want to start a band?" He says, "Well, actually, I play guitar." I said, "Well, I know a guy named Stu Cook, whose dad's a rich lawyer, and he's got a rumpus room with a piano, and it's in tune, and we can practice there." Well, that would be Stu, our bass player for Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Sure, sure.
And we were an instrumental trio, but without any bass, except for Stu's left hand. So it was piano. John had a little Silvertone guitar and amp, and I had a four-piece drum set. And that's how it all started. And then Tom Fogerty was in a band, a pretty good one, Spiderweb and the Insects, they were called. Pretty cool name. And he had the idea of recording and taking a demo down to L.A. and trying to get a deal for his band. So when he came in to practice, he said, "Okay, guys, I want to talk to you." He says, "I'm going to teach you these two songs on the piano, and we'll arrange them. And then once we've got it figured out, I've got studio time, so we're going to go and record these. And then I'm going to L.A. and try and get a deal for us." And the guys in the band said, "Are we getting paid?" He says, "No, it's costing me a fortune. This is for your future." And somebody else blurted out, "Are there going to be any chicks there?" And he says, "No, we're going to be recording these songs to try and make a deal in L.A. And they said, "We'd rather work on our cars." Prototypical. Anyway, Tom was very supportive of the three of us. He would come to our gigs when he could, and he'd actually sing a song or two. And that was really cool when we had a singer singing with us. And
can you tell me about the first gig?
Yeah, the first gig was at the El Cerrito. That's where we were living, in the East Bay area of San Francisco Bay Area. And it was at the Boys Club. Sorry, girls, it wasn't the Boys and Girls Club at that time.
I remember.
They weren't very progressive back
no,
then.
No.
So, but anyway, I remember it. I made an impression on my dad because I made $5 we made $5 each. So it cost $15 for the van. Of course, a dollar bought a lot more. It does today, but still, it was the idea that, you know, we had a little set that we played, and people were dancing and having a good time, and I felt great to be able to play in the band, in front of our peers.
And what did you call the band?
The Blue Velvets.
Blue Velvets. Yeah, I've read about that. Because I'm always mixed up about the timeline and stuff. So this first gig, and you guys are instrumental, so you're playing music for people to dance to. Some covers, some original?
Yes, exactly. Some covers and some originals. Exactly what we did. And in those days, in Top 40 Radio, you could have Harry Mancini's orchestra play a song from a movie, and then Little Richard would come out and, you know, play one of his songs. So it was a pretty big scale, a wide gap of music types in Top 40. And then, of course, the R&B stuff was R&B, and then there was country radio, and I listened to all of it, but mostly the Top 40, because those songs were hits, and so I was listening to what was being played by the best, and then the R&B stuff I felt different when I played it. It's just a great groove that they were laying down. A lot of those guys were in the same bands in New Orleans, certainly.
Earl Palmer?
Yeah, that's right. My man.
Yeah, incredible drummer man. I think he kind of came up with the kick drum for rock and roll.
Yeah, he mastered that for sure. And a lot of the guys would go there. Little Richard's band recorded there. Fats Domino recorded there. Several singers would put their best work in New Orleans, so that had a big influence on with the R&B thing and rock and roll having a beat to it.
I've even read that the trap kit was invented in New Orleans.
I believe it was.
Yeah, the contraption, right? I want to play something here, Clifford Wright, called I Need Your Love.
Hey, Deterioration Acquisition. Hello.
Hello.
You're a noise musician, visual artist, and instrument maker, native from San Francisco, but working in Boston, USA. Your artistic practice is concerned with the specialty and physicality of sound and its relationship to the human body. You're going to present a performance tomorrow, Friday, October 18, at the festival. So to start our interview, I suggest you to talk about your interest in your artistic approach. Your artistic approach or path emphasizes the spaciousness and physicality of sound and its relationship to the human body. Why this approach?
Okay. I just feel like we have no choice other than to make sense of the world through our relationship between our body and the spaces that we inhabit. In all of my performances, I try to make site-specific, and it's in the service of kind of making sure that you're present. And I think it's like I present my sound in a way where it's not separate from the gestural aspect of like me like turning a knob or something like that. You see there's an interaction between the body and the way sound is created. And I think in a lot of electronic music, there's that divide there, which is why I think a lot of laptop artists, no offense to laptop artists, they lose a little bit of the compellingness of like the interaction between the sound and like the human performer. So I like to inhabit a space in a way where my body is directly interacting with the space itself, and the sound itself is also interacting with the space. So I mean, it sounds kind of like a tautology, but I think the feedback kind of aspect of it, like this impinges on that, which is impinging on the sound that's like falling on your ears, is a really kind of compelling idea and dimension to play with.
You mentioned before that you work in the field of technology, and you manufacture instruments, and you can therefore very precisely configure your sound devices. What tool do you use to support your artistic approach, and how do you create your own device?
Okay, so Jessica Ryland, my mentor, and she's the one who taught me how to build electronics. So my induction into kind of the experimental sound world started from a very granular, basic, fundamental level. And so I think I have this kind of like, think about like, I guess like a painter who also like mixes their own paints and stuff like that. So they have this super in-depth control and understanding of the kind of medium that they're working in. And so I feel like a lot of the times like that will inform the ultimate product, the ultimate sound. So, you know, it came from even like picking out certain transistors that were noisier than others. And so like my synth, The Jealous Heart, has like these, we called it the Cadillac transistors, that have this extremely like beautiful, rich kind of like noise that they produce, richer than others. Not to say that it's, the other products are not good, but this in particular, you know, I can have a very distinct sound, I think. So I think it works to my advantage in that I can create incredibly specific sounds and like noises that I haven't heard, you know, from other instruments. And so I can tailor things to my taste. Yeah, I think being able to also work on a very fundamental level gives me a lot of ability to branch outward. So not only am I doing like analog synthesis, but I'm also building instruments that use like motors, and like I'm taking like different parts from other instruments, like piano parts, and like using those, incorporating those into my work. So I think that gives me an ability to like move laterally and have a wide variety of different approaches and sounds, because I'm coming from this very basic level.
Thank you very much, Victoria Shen. Mm-hmm. To learn more about you, go to evishen.com.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Walk for Pedro show. Clifford Wright with I Need Your Love. Then Clank Quartet after that. Scotty, North Carolina. Geez, forgive my misanthropy. That's a complicated word. Sam Locke Ward after that. Where is it at? Where it at? Love 2019 interview. Victoria Shen. Then Bombas Prendon, D.C. area. Bayou Doe Eyes. DDCB06 from Thor Harris. Rob Halverson with Bill Callahan. 57 brand new from P. Kane. And finally, Clifford Wright with She Told Me So. So, you guys doing that journey to SoCal to record them songs, is it still Blue Velvets?
No. When we played the songs when Tom came, we were it was Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets.
So you become his backup band?
Well, half the time.
Okay. I'm trying to understand.
We were near Cal Berkeley. It was just a couple miles from where we lived, and so we would play frat parties a lot. And the money was good, and they would buy us beer as well. double incentive there.
Yeah.
But and Tom was married and had a wife and kids and a family and all of that and a job, and that happened later on. We changed our names. We were unfortunately named the Gollywogs by the record company.
I've read about that name.
Oh.
I just wondered where that came from.
Well, it didn't come from us. and worse than that, the outfits that we had to wear, everybody wore the same uniform. It was a white and red paisley shirt, quilt pants, like 4-inch squares, these weird colors, a green suede vest, and white Cossack hats. So after the night or the day after a gig, I walked around with a very stiff neck because I played with my head down. It was horribly embarrassing.
Okay. Yeah. And whose idea is this? The record, the same ones with the Gollywog name? Yeah.
Yeah. He named us and he dressed us. neither one was good.
Yeah. So, but Tom, ends up joining your, half the time you guys are your trio, and then half the time you're backing him up, but he comes to join, your trio band?
Yeah, we decided that, we couldn't, we had a regional hit. Stu Cook and I were Stu Cook being the bass player for Creedence Clearwater Revival, and my old pal of 60 years. And I went to San Jose State. We were going to college. Tom was working for PG&E, and John was working in the mailroom at the record company. And we realized then, when we had this hit. It was number one in San Jose, number one in Sacramento, and a few other places across the country. And we made a little money on that, which allowed us to buy new gear. Nobody bought a car or any of that. We spent every penny. I got a brand new trap set, which was so cool. And the guys got amps and so on and so forth. But we realized that part-time bands have part-time hits. So if we want to take this dream and give it every chance it can have to come true, we had to do nothing but be musicians and play six nights a week, five sets a night. We get our stuff together. But the downside to that, nobody's making any money.
Yeah.
And Tom, once again, was the hero. He had some credit cards, and we would use the credit card till we got our second sheriff's warning on that card. And then we'd pay what we could afford on that card. And we'd kind of rotate the cards. And that's how we did it. And he also gave up the lead singing rights to John, because John had a more of a rock and roll voice than Tom. Tom was a balladeer. He could sing rock and roll, but he was a smooth tenor, and John was a sandpaper
tenor. Right. John had to rock and roll. So let me ask you, when you were playing with Tom as the singer, did you play drums different than when John was the singer?
Probably, more than likely. Now that I think about it, it's not something I ever really thought about, but it was harder edged, and the music is in your head and in your heart, we were definitely a better rocking band than we were with Tom, he was a great supporter of the band and band leader, and made decisions that other guys wouldn't have made, but it was for the best and the betterment of the band.
I think his rhythm guitar was pretty crucial.
Unsung.
Yeah, really good.
John wouldn't let him sing or submit material. And he never thought that was coming. He never thought that was part of the plan. We never would have made it. He owed it to him to let him sing a song like maybe La Bamba. That would have been a perfect song for him. But John wouldn't do it. And so that was a point of argument between the three of us and him. But I don't want to...
Yeah, we don't have to get into that. What about other drummers that were playing with you? Did you look to any of those cats for what they were doing?
I'd always check them out, and we went to there was a point when you could go into the black neighborhoods and go into some of the clubs in there, and we were underage for sure, but we saw Howlin' Wolf, we saw all these great guys and their bands. So I could sit on the floor as long as we weren't being seen or in the way, and just watch them. What I mainly watched is I watched their feet, because that was the difference maker in the R&B stuff.
You're talking the kick in the hat.
My idol was Al Jackson Jr.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Virginia good. MGs, and most people don't realize that, Green Onions was an instrumental hit by those guys, but everyone thinks that's all they did, but they were the house band for Stax.
Sure.
So Otis Redding, all those records that you hear Otis Redding singing on, they're playing the music, and Al Jackson was playing the drums.
Yeah, it is beautiful. I love it. I love it.
And one of my best friends from the old days, I miss him terribly. He's just the badass,
Kicked up much dust. Look, Cosmo, we're at the end of the first hour. June 14, 2021, Dish Watt Peter Show, special guest Doug Clifford. Hold tack for hour two. June 14, 2021, it's the second hour of the Watt for Pedro Show.
After my soulmate, this dog named Poquita, died, I built a lot of these wooden dogs that were sort of, you know, they looked sort of like her. I still have her skull around here somewhere. That's something a crazy person would say, right? All of these things that I've done, like I make things, that's so therapeutic for me, combating depression.
It's not that I'm completely fearless about people's judgments about me and my mental illness. It's just that the secrecy is so potentially lethal. The reason I wear this skull face makeup is in my book. My head is a skull.
In 1992, sleep began to elude me, replaced by terror and sweating cold. I began having panic attacks. It took all of my will just to keep from running screaming out of the grocery store or the bicycle shop where I worked. My brain was becoming a burning cell from which I could see no escape. The chemistry in my brain changed drastically enough that I didn't feel like myself anymore. None of my gauges were working anymore. The things like my sense of humor and my sense of justice, and that was all just getting foggy and busted and lost. Weeks passed and my mind grew darker and smaller. It felt like myself was dissolving. It felt like there was something horrible going on inside my head that if people looked at me, they could see. And it would be so hideous that it would just turn the world against me. I used to work at the suicide hotline. That was a great job. It didn't stress me out or bum me out to talk to sad, lonely people on the phone. Most of them just needed like somebody to talk to, you know, some neutral, non-judgmental ear. And I had certainly been to hell and back with clinical depression. When I started taking these pills, I hated the idea of having to take pills probably for the rest of my life, but it's no big deal. We all have to eat every day. We all have needs. We all need Twitter and Instagram, and some of us need to eat a pill in the morning. Like espresso, that's a lot more trouble than taking a pill, but also worth it. Exercise has just tremendous effects on neurochemistry. More than just about anything, tons of exercise has been an antidepressant for me. Hi. Hi, Stella.
The last time I thought about committing suicide was 2 years ago when me and Marianne broke up, and I went into a pretty dark, depressive episode. Not that we've said goodbye, we're like best friends now.
When he starts to get depressed, I can see it happening because he's a lot less responsive, a lot less verbal. It's hard to watch somebody retreat like that and not really be able to do anything. Just make sure he knows he's not alone.
A lot of people with depression sleep 18 hours a day. I am one of the people that has depression that can't sleep.
And of course that began to really wreak havoc on my brain chemistry because I stayed awake for so long.
It just felt like everything inside me was just burned and awful. Every thought had like a predator behind it.
I rode my bike in the burning sun down a long country road. On the road, I saw a smashed snake. I laid down on the scalding hot road beside the snake. We were dead. The sky was fire. I decided to kill myself. Our strongest instinct is supposed to be self-preservation, so it's really odd when someone kills themselves. Part of me wanted to do that, but obviously other huge, powerful parts of me would not let that happen. I've told myself so many times how glad I was that I didn't quit life at 27, and I've toured the world a bunch of times over and met so many wonderful people, and I almost denied myself all of that in one action. I in no way think of this lost year as wasted, more like a horrifying trip through a wilderness of dementia from which I emerged fearless and irrepressible. That's my book. Love is like the antidote. For some reason, these brilliant people see something worth loving in me. So sometimes you just have to rely on the love that other people have for you. Once I visited a place that felt like death, being alive was by contrast so much more colorful. I've made this life for myself that allows me the time to feel joy and be around the people I love and the animals. Going through depression, I'm grateful for the things that it taught me.
shame. I always had a dream of loving you one day.
Yeah.
You know, they were one of them, Clapton and Jack Bruce.
Jack Bruce, big effect on me.
And boy, there. Yeah, I definitely did. And Dave Garibaldi from Tower of Power.
Yeah.
Took those guys on their first national tour. And, man, I stay in touch with Dave on occasion. In fact, I owe him an email.
Okay.
Thanks for reminding me.
No problem. Let's tell the people we heard Clifford Wright doing Lost Pride Fever, then Thor Harris with Major Depression Chapter 1. Great drummer man out of Austin. Lisa Cameron, Sandy Ewan with Live at Lawndale 1 in Houston. Lisa Cameron's at Joshua Tree right now recording with Uncle Ecstasy people. Great drummer. Doug, finally Clifford Wright, getting that together. I see your silhouette. So, you know, when I look at those pictures at those big arena or stadium gigs, it seems the drummers don't have monitors. Did you guys have monitors?
We had monitors. We had stacks, and then we switched to 15-inch wedges on the floor. On left and right in stereo for me.
Oh, okay.
The guys had stacks, so they would have those off to the side and be replaying them. And you know, the Clifford Wright thing, and so on, that was cut 35 years ago. Recorded 35 years ago, and I found it. And there's like five or six albums worth of stuff, including a solo album that I did, and another album with Bobby Whitlock in a different band. And so it's, I call it Cosmos Vault. So it's kind of a series of music that's going to be coming out of that vault. And right now, the Clifford Wright, that was Steve Wright from Greg Kinn Band, bass player,
yeah,
extraordinaire. and co-writer of Jeopardy. He's from El Cerrito as well. And his brother was in the class behind us, and he was almost going to be in Credence, but the problem with him was he was always getting in fights, and we realized that we were playing some pretty rough joints back then, and not a good idea to have a bad fight, because...
Yeah, throwing some guzzles, okay. So this Clifford Wright album... did you plan it out, or was it just like jamming around and then you ended up with all these songs?
Well, we Steve and I wrote all those songs. We wrote a lot, and we have still there's some other stuff that isn't on that record really, because there's 11 songs on there already, but yeah, we had a real good writing routine, and we were very productive. And I think that's a really good album. We got three great guitar players on it. We've got Joe Satriani. We've got Greg Douglas.
Joe Satriani was in the Greg Kidd Band, huh?
Yeah, he was, all three of these guys. And then Jimmy Lyon also plays on that on a couple of songs. So, and then Steve and I are the rhythm section, and then Keith England is the singer, and he does just a terrific job. Grungy, high tenor. I love Keith. I'm hoping for success on this album, and I think there are hits in there, but more so than for myself. I want to see Keith England have his day in Hitsville, because he's been, that was done 35 years ago, and he's still trying to make it, and he's just a terrific guy, and he still can hit those high notes, which is pretty amazing for a guy his age. But
yeah, so you say 1986, and where did you do it?
We were in 1986. And we did it in about 9 recording sessions. So we did it all over the Bay Area.
Oh, it was in the Bay, okay. Because,
one up in Reno, Nevada. But, we had some real high-rated pedigree players on that record.
Well, I want to play Real Love, okay?
Real Love's a good one, too.
Bye. into the cold water. I couldn't wait to be embraced, if not for them, by it, by you. I'm just sitting here, envisaging the future, hot and smoky. Couldn't wait to be embraced, if not by them, by it.
Thank you. faces shine. Real old mine. I'm a real old mine. Real old mine.
Watford Pedro Show, Clifford Wright with Real Love, then Ben Salter from Tasmania with Cost, Down on the Street, Stooges live in Detroit 2003, Joe Wong. Got to thank Joe Wong because he kind of made this connect cap, Cosmo.
Oh, yeah.
Nuclear Rainbow, an instrumental off his new solo album. Then Ginger Baker with Cream doing this at their last gig at the Albert Hall, Toad. And, yeah, he's going for it. And then finally, You Keep Running Away, Clifford Wright. So,
I like that one.
Yeah. What was the process? Like, who came up with... But even in Creedence days, were you ever involved with the composing?
Well, we weren't allowed, so, you know, it wasn't something I was interested in doing because I couldn't do anything with it. But after the band broke up, then I started recording, and I needed material, and I wanted to write my own, so I started writing. And, you know, it's... now I've got well over 100 songs that are recordable.
Can I ask you what you compose? Do you compose on the drums?
No. Well, yes and no. I like co-writing, but when I co-write, I only like to write with one other person, because once you get more than one, then you end up kind of trying to find your way in. And then you know, people start worrying about how much they've contributed and this, that, the other thing. I'm a lyricist, and when I write by myself, and I do that, I use the piano.
Okay, because you know Chico Hamilton tried to get songwriting credits, and this is the jazz world. They said no, drummers can't write songs.
Oh no, that is just see.
That's terrible.
That's arrogance right there.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. You know, I played a song from the Stooges. They told me that when they were in Los Angeles in Hollywood recording Funhouse in 1970, the sax man, Brother Steve McKay, he told me that you took them for a ride in a convertible. Do you remember that?
I did.
Yeah. Not the whole band. It was just the drummer man, Scott Ashton, and the sax man, Steve McKay.
I've never had a convertible, so I must have stolen it.
Okay. You never know. You know, people tell you this.
I was probably drinking, so...
And here's another Stooges story. The drummer man, Scott Rock Action was his nickname. The manager told him, they had a manager in 1970. He said, look, if the Stooges are going to have a hit, you got to play drums more like Doug Clifford. I shit you not.
Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea, because you know we made a point of less is best. And,
yeah.
And it took us 10 years before we had our first hit record, so we had to stick in there and we had to keep the genre where it was, because we were in the middle of psychedelica in the 60s in the Bay Area. That wasn't us. We weren't going to do it because it was popular. We were going to do what we do best and what we love. And our peers laughed at us, called us the Boy Scouts of Rock and Roll. And we'd never make it. So, last laughs are...
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I remember, you know, sometimes these gigs, I played 125 months with those guys, and sometimes the gigs were far away from the venue, so we were riding back from one in France, and I put the iPod things in Scotty's ears. It was off Pendulum. It's called It's Just a Thought, and at the end there, you start playing these fills that are so fucking bitching.
That was a good record, you know. And it was different because John played the organ a lot.
Yeah, right, and some saxophone, and there's hardly any guitar from him.
Yeah, and that was because we took Booker T and the MGs on 31 dates in America with us. It was their first national tour ever, and they made more money than they ever made playing live, because we were playing Coliseums.
Yeah, that was very kind of you.
And we took good care of them. We learned a lot from those guys. You know, they were... They were terrific musicians and just wonderful people.
Duck Dunn on the bass, righteous.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I've done several albums with Duck.
Wow. I'm a big student of his. We're at the end of the second hour, June 14, 2021, Dish Wap Pedro Show special guest, Doug Clifford. Hold tight for hour three. June 14, 2021, it's the third hour of the Wap for Pedro Show.
Time. You can't save my life. Just Anyway, so I wanted to ask you about your good time, long-time friend of yours, Jim Keltner. You haven't
seen
Jim
Keltner. Lord.
He's such a great guy.
Yeah, he's another Tulsa guy.
I did not know he was from Tulsa.
Yeah, yeah. And he's still with his wife. They went to high school together, and he's been with the same person for all
these years. When was the first time you met Jim Keltner?
Well, when I went out to California, and it was with Delaney and Bonnie. You know, he was part of the scene, Keltner was. And, you know, he was our drummer. Jimmy Karstein was the original drummer. And a Tulsa guy, all right? And then Keltner became our drummer with Delaney and Bonnie and friends. Another Tulsa guy. And then he gave the spot up for Jim Gordon, you know, to be with Delaney and Bonnie. And, oh, man, Keltner, his thing was, Delaney told me, he said, he hears, because I couldn't figure out why suddenly we have Jim Gordon in our band.
Right.
You know, and it was a different, what Keltner did.
He's very musical.
There was a musical reasoning behind everything, and I understood that. There was some musical logic behind everything Delaney did or orchestrated. There was a key to something. Well, this is a key that I'd never, because I'm used to Al Jackson, zing, zing, back, and Howard Grimes, zing, zing, back, you know, laying it down in Memphis. And then when we get out here, Keltner had a different touch. He heard everything. He heard everything that everybody was doing, you know, and not hear it just like the audible of it, but the essence of it.
Right.
He heard that, you see. And so a lot of his playing, he gets so involved musically. He's a real musical drummer, you know, and it's like this, floats like a butterfly and stings like a bee, all right? And boy, when that snare comes on alive, it's like pow, you know. But it's just like, Keltner will play with his fingers. He'll do things that are really just to suit the atmosphere of the song. And Jim Gordon, we had a band with horns and, you know, it was like a kicking band. And Jim Gordon was just the drummer. The right drummer for Delaney and Bonnie and friends, you know. Keltner said it, you know.
Yeah, Jim Gordon was more like a freight train.
Oh, he was. He was a freight train. He was the engine of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And, man, that guy, and it's not volume. And it's technique and the way he played. Not technique. I hate that word. Touch and feel. Jim Gordon just came from another school. And he locked that thing in on. Listen to California Dreamin' album. That's all Jim Gordon on that. I didn't know it until he told me after we was with Derek and the Dominoes. I mean, but this guy had a way of fitting everybody that he played with. He could go right to their heart, and he could drive them too. You know, he did all this incredible percussion stuff. You know, so when he came to be with us. Hollywood Jim, you know, Skippy, as Frank Zappa called him. Clean cut, you know. Really, he didn't look like he just come out, bought his clothes out of a magazine, you know, one of those.
Right.
With not really good taste either, you know. But, man, when he kicked it down, forget about it. The whole thing, I mean, and so we had Carl and Jim, and Carl was right on Jim's kick drum. Boom, I mean, that band moved. Fixed stages. And when we, at the time we had, Dave Mason, George Harrison, and Eric Clapton were our guitar players on one of our one and only European tour. Lord have mercy. We did. We played halls, you know, old auditoriums, and they had fixed stage, that stages were part of the building. And you could see the speakers moving, you know.
I read where the that tour was only 3 weeks.
Yeah, it wasn't very long. No. And it didn't take them that long to to do what needed to be done.
Well, and getting back to Jim Keltner again, he was on the original Delaney and Bonnie.
Yeah.
And the song that really always stuck out in my mind with him playing was We've Got to Get Ourselves Together, and that intro. Did-a-little-diddle-diddle-da.
Yeah.
Boy, that intro with Jim Keltner was just beautiful.
Yeah, well, all of the things that he did were just pretty amazing. So, see, for that album wasn't a freight train album, you know?
But, I mean, who came up with that intro? Was that a Delaney intro, or is that...
The melody
We've
of
We've got
it?
To get ourselves together in the
intro. Yeah, I would imagine it's either Delaney or Jerry McGee. You know, it's a...
But the drums are playing right there.
Well, that would be Jim's thing. I mean, he took care of the drums. Delaney never told anybody what to do. He told me, surround yourself with people as good as you are. I took that advice a step further, and I surrounded myself with people who are better at doing what they do as I am doing what I'm doing. And so that takes a little bit of the burden off, you know.
You want to drive? Chris? Thank you.
Walk for Pedro. Show started off the third hour with Just in the Nick of Time, Clifford Wright. Percussion discussion, Charles Mingus and Max Roach, 1955. Live at the Bohemia. Jim Keltner versus Jim Gordon. Bobby Whitlock, Coco Carmel talking these days. Everywhere We Go, Baguetta, Keltner, Watt. I got to record with Jim Keltner. Tulsa guy. Great cat. And finally, Clifford Wright with Weekends. Can I ask you, did you ever get into big hi-hats?
I have 18-inch hi-hats.
What was the idea behind that?
Well, you know, one of the things I noticed, most of the songs we played were playing eighth notes on the hi-hat.
Yeah.
And you know, hi-hats are generally 14 inches.
Right, right.
They were back then. And they had no tone. I only had one crash cymbal, and then I used the ride cymbal a lot as a crash cymbal, but it would be a lower register cymbal because of the size of it.
Sure.
But I played a lot of that, and so...
You know, the greatest crashes is you guys cover, I've heard it through the grapevine, where you put the crash on the four.
Yeah, exactly.
And that dually you do with John at the end, was that a jam or was it planned? Or
well, it was a combination of two things. We it was some of it was jamming, and we never did that. We always rehearsed and played the song exactly the way we rehearsed it. But it just I got going and I just forgot where I was.
It's great.
I started going with it, and then he jumped on. When I realized, you know, oh shit, this isn't what we practice. And I looked at him, and I said, you got us here, you know. So
it kind of happens again in Pagan Baby a little bit, but
what I
read was the only jam song, totally from a jam, was Born on the Bayou.
That was the one that we played in the clubs, because that was our second album, on our second album.
Sure, Bayou Country.
And that's my favorite Creedence song.
Oh, man. Whose idea was the cowbell?
I played quarter notes through that whole song.
Sure.
So that set the cowbell up for a home run.
You know, that's an important music concept. You set it up. That's how you get an ensemble, you get the interesting conversation going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your fills, the way you got into verses, got into choruses, come out of bridges, all that setup stuff you did with fills is so happening.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm not a flashy guy or a technician, but I'm a field player.
Yeah, big time.
And all the, you know, all those gigs that we played in the bars where you were playing five sets a night and playing, you know, somebody else's records and their hits. And so the fills were based on those. But a lot of them I would, like, cut in half, where they were using the tempo in four
right.
A lot. And moving, you know, moving sections. From verse to chorus to verse, there's a difference. Al Jackson Jr. and I became really good friends, and he never brought sticks out and said, you know, do this, do that. We just talked, and he said, what are your goals? And I said, I want to be a metronome. He says, why would you want to do that? I says, well, because John wants a metronome. He says, a metronome is a machine. You're a human being, and there's a space between rushing and dragging, and then the middle of the note. And you know, sometimes you hear it, and when you're going into that chorus or a solo, you know it, something's coming. You let that heart beat a little bit, but you know, don't go too far past. Then you're rushing. And then it's the same thing when you've had that excitement of a solo or you know, the chorus is the money part, and you're coming back down into settling into the verse. You can settle it back just a hair, but it's got to be in your heart. You got to let your heart do it.
Yeah.
And holy cow, that's the best advice I've ever got. And he says, well, you do it anyway. And I said, yeah, but I never thought about it before.
It's natural, Cosmo. Yeah. Here, I want to play Lonesome Boy.
Bye.
Wop for Pedro Show, last music for this edition. Clifford Wright with Lonesome Boy. Then Mike Cooper with Vital Alsar. Fair Forward from John Duncan and Stefano Pelia. And finally, Clifford Wright with You're Gonna Love Again. Man. What you're saying is, with this Clifford Wright record, it's actually the first of a bunch of releases that's coming of old stuff.
That's right.
Okay. And where can people find you on the internet?
It hasn't been officially released yet.
Okay, when's that going to happen?
27th of August.
Okay, a couple months, okay.
A couple months, but there's going to be two singles released before that. On the 13th of July, For All the Money in the World, it's going to be a single.
Yeah.
And the 3rd of August is going to be, I Need Your Love.
Okay. And where can people hear? Is there a website?
They can hear it on your show.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But, I mean, on those dates when the stuff gets released, where can they go?
Oh, well, all the regular suspects.
Okay. I was wondering if there was a Cosmo website.
Oh, yeah, there isn't, but it's we're waiting. This is going to be on my label.
Oh, okay. You've got a label now. Okay.
I've got a label now, and it's going to be distributed by Sony. And I'm waiting to... There, it's a fellow named Bob Frank has Sony Orchard distributorship, and he's been around for years, and he loves the record.
Oh,
and
great.
We're going to be using a lot of independent radio people. I've got my own... My own press agent. And so we're going to be coordinating all this, and I want to bring these guys in, and that's why we're going to have those two singles out in front. And Cosmo, you can go to my website. It's DougCosmoClifford.com.
Okay. You hear that, people? DougCosmoClifford.com. And can I ask, are you going to have gigs going along with this release?
I miss that.
Gigs, performances.
No gigs. I have Parkinson's.
Oh, so, I'm so sorry.
I'm lucky. Stu and I had a band called Creedence Clearwater Revisited for 25 years. We've been on the road, and last February was our last two gigs, and two months later, the whole industry shuts down.
That's right.
We looked at each other and said, "It's like we knew."
Yeah, absolutely. But the music's coming out and stuff. And what do you think? Like 4 or 5 albums?
Yeah, I definitely do. I've got one with Bobby Whitlock. I've got this one. I've got one with me as a solo artist. I've got a bunch of stuff.
With you as a solo artist, it's not just you playing. Do you have sidemen? But you did all the material yourself.
Well, I had to use sidemen for sure. But with the one with Whitlock was a band that we had that we're trying to get a deal for. And it just didn't plan out.
Right.
His wife didn't like living in the Bay Area, so that took care of that. Steve Wright died, so that kind of took care of that.
Yeah.
You know, but it's they're all coming out of Cosmo's vault, and that's what we're going to use it to make it like a little series. You know, fresh from Cosmo's vault, that would be me, my vault.
Yeah.
I've got some pretty good music.
And people, you got to understand, Cosmo's, the Creedence album, that was the name of their practice pad.
Yeah, their practice pad and our biggest album, Cosmo's Factory.
Right, that's right. And I love it. Those first 6 records, oh my God. When you go out, you get in the van with White, you're going to hear all 6 in order. Because I just love it. I mean, I hate to blame you, but a lot of inspiration from you, Cosmos. Thank you so much for being on the show, truly.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, anytime you want to come on, you just tell me when you get these new records or whatever. Big love.
I'll say, hey, what's up?
Thank you much. People, it's been June 14, 2021 edition of WAP Pedo Show. Keep your powder dry.